Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to the Money Show on this Tuesday night, brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank, I'm just looking through your comments this evening on my Facebook page, facebook.com/BruceBusiness, and seeing lots of very positive commentary on the discussion I had last night, Make Money Mondays discussion last night with Magda Wyrzycka, Chief Executive of Signia. And a lot of you got completely taken aback by her approach towards money, the way in which she deals with money and the way in which she thinks about money. So yes, have a listen to those podcasts. They're available on our website. And also you can follow us on the Facebook page, of course, facebook.com/BruceBusiness. Coming up on the show this evening, Carol Payton, the editor-at-large at Business Day. I'm looking forward to catching up with her in just a moment as we find former government ministers quitting Parliament altogether. What opportunities does that bring for the country? We'll talk to the Cabin Crew Association as to why they're standing up for Vuyani Jahana. I don't think they've ever stood up before for a chief executive, either pressurized out, who went on their own behalf, or was pushed out. We'll talk to Andy Rice with our Heroes and Zeros feature from the world of advertising. Ronak Kapoldas in studio with us this evening. He is with our Africa Business Report and the diabolical goings on in Sudan, very much top of mind. And then 100 years and growing strong, Lumpo Vyek Blot. Chris Burgess, the editor of that publication, on a day where the working group has handed to the presidency its thoughts and its documents and its investigation into land reform. So all of that is critical. That's what we're going to be talking about this evening. But coming up first in the next 18 minutes or so, your chance to win 2,000 Rand in cash, courtesy of 702 Cape Talk and Altron, there when it matters. And I would like to know from you, please, who uses Taiwan-based Honhai Precision Industry to make its devices? There's a company in Taiwan called Honhai Precision Industry. Who uses them to make their devices? That is your Fast Fact question this evening on 31702 or 31567. Give us an SMS this evening. I would love to hear from you tonight, and you could be the person who wins 2,000 Rand in cash, courtesy of Altron, there when it matters.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live, online, smartphones, DSTV, and 92.7 and 106 FM.
Well, first it was CEOs falling like flies, and now it's former cabinet ministers. A growing number of the 14 former cabinet ministers who didn't make the cut into the Ramaphosa cabinet have been handing in letters of resignation to Parliament, choosing to quit mainstream politics altogether. Today we saw the names of Derek Hanekom and Batabile Dlamini added to that list. Carol Payton is at Business Day. She joins us on the line from Johannesburg this evening. More often than not, Carol, ex-cabinet ministers don't go back to the back benches. Some do, but the vast majority quit. Why?
Well, I think for lots of reasons. I'm sure some of them do have other opportunities out there. But I think one of the big reasons is that when you cease to be a minister, a member of the executive, a minister or a deputy minister, and that your term of office comes to an end, Parliament pays you a gratuity. Pays you a gratuity which is worth about, you know, third of your salary over a third of your annual salary for every 5 years that you spend. So you can get, you know, if you're a minister and you're earning 2.4 million and then you get, you know, a third of that as a gratuity, it's quite a substantial amount of money. So somebody like Jeff Radebe, you know, who served 5 terms, is going to get, you know, 20 months worth of his salary, of his annual salary, which is 2.4 million, plus another, I don't know, 1.2. So it's quite a good amount of money to say no to.
Absolutely. I mean, Pravin Gordhan was different. He took the back seat after being fired along with Mthabisi Jonas. Jonas, of course, went off and he's carving out a private sector career for himself. And Pravin Gordhan from the back bench back onto the front bench and back into cabinet once again. I suppose it depends on your outlook politically as to what you think, you know, how long your shelf life is.
Exactly. I think it depends on your prospects. I think it depends on your convictions. you know, I think Pravin Gordhan wouldn't want to be one of those people who went into the private sector. So he was involved at that point in trying to dislodge, you know, Jacob Zuma. So I think he had every motivation to stay. But I think that this, you know, these people who are quitting now, are obviously have decided, well, you know, the good times are over for them when it comes to the cabinet. So, let's move on and look at other opportunities and at the same time take that very nice gratuity from Parliament. Which you would not otherwise get.
No, you wouldn't want to turn your nose up at it. No, you certainly wouldn't want to do that. How many of the 14 who were excluded from the Ramaphosa cabinet have resigned now from Parliament? It's a growing list.
Okay, I'm not keeping track. I think it's about 9. I'm not sure. There were more today. I'm not entirely sure exactly how many.
I mean, you talk about them going on to other opportunities, and many of them, I mean, I don't want to prejudge individuals, you'd know them better than I, wouldn't have private sector opportunities necessarily opened to them. Many have burnt bridges with the private sector. How many ambassadorial posts or other jobs within the ANC are there for people who have walked out of the cushy comfort of politics?
Oh, you know, I think there are just so many jobs. I think that's one of the problems with South Africa, in fact, is that there are just so many jobs, whether they are in the state, whether they're in the foreign service, whether they are in state-owned enterprises, whether they're on boards of state-owned enterprises, whether they are in CETAs, whether they are, you know, there are just dozens and dozens of opportunities. So I wouldn't say that, you know, there are no opportunities out there. And I think that, you know, somebody like Jeff Khadebe, who's very accomplished, very experienced, is probably going to get some very senior appointments, government appointments at some point somewhere, I would imagine.
It'd be interesting to see where he does turn up. Yeah. I mean, somebody like Abatibile Dlamini, I mean, she had a go of practically everybody except herself in a resignation letter today.
Exactly. So someone like her, I wouldn't have been surprised if she had stayed, just for the mere fact of, like, well, what is she going to do now? Because she might get the gratuity, but what does she do for the next 5 years? Because actually, if she stayed in Parliament, just as a backbencher, she would earn more over the 5 years that she's going to get in the gratuity. But that said, I mean, obviously she has to pitch up at Parliament. But I don't think that there are dozens of opportunities for her out there. But as you say, she hasn't endeared herself to the private sector. She doesn't seem to have the skills that they'd want. And also in the public sector, she's probably burnt her bridges there. I don't think there are too many people who are going to be giving her board positions and so on after what went down at SASSA.
Mm. I mean, it does provide the ANC for an opportunity for quite a big refresh. Is the party going to use this opportunity wisely, do you think?
Well, I think it's a positive thing that people who've been around, I mean, I think that there weren't enough new and young people on the ANC list. But whether the party is refreshed or not depends who's coming in and their places. And I actually don't know many of the people who are coming in. And if the people who are coming in are not fresh, quite accomplished,
where's Carol Payton? There she is. Yes. Sorry, you disappeared for a moment. You disappeared for a moment. You were saying the people coming in. Yes, you are.
Yeah, I was saying the people coming in, it's hard to know what the caliber of those people is because we don't know them at this point. But, I mean, what is sorely needed at Parliament is a fresh bunch of people of a higher caliber. And we're not quite sure yet what we're going to get out of the new MPs that are coming in.
Well, what's your reading of the lie of the battle lines right now? I mean, the president has been stunningly silent in his personal capacity on S. Mahashule breaking ranks on the Reserve Bank. He's in Switzerland now. He's at the International Labour Organization in Geneva, where it's cold and rainy, so we know he didn't go for the weather. You know, do we see him coming out fighting in the State of the Nation address? You know him better than most.
Look, I think he will be his usual presidential self. I don't think he's going to come out fighting an ANC fight, but I mean, I would imagine he's got some big announcements. We certainly are expecting some big announcements around Eskom, for instance, he's certainly raised expectations that he will be making some big announcements. So I think that's where he'll be heading. I think as far as the sort of balance of forces goes, I think the quitting of the Batabiles and the Nombulos and those sorts of people who were very firmly opposed to Ramaphosa, those people leaving parliament is obviously a good thing for him because it means there's less opposition in the parliamentary caucus. So I think that is all works in his favour, and I do get the overall impression that the number of people who are firmly opposed to Ramaphosa, both in parliament and the NEC, in the ANC more broadly, are diminishing.
My thanks to Carol Payton, a journalist and writer of Business Day, very attuned to what is going on within politics. And yeah, we've got just over a week to go for that State of the Nation address. It happens next Thursday night. The president usually steps up to the podium, opposition benches permitting, at about 7 p.m. and delivers a State of the Nation. If he is going to be brief, like Tito Mboweni was in the budget speech, we could have it all done and dusted in 45 minutes. He may choose to use an hour and a half of time to outline a bold vision of the future. But yeah, is he better off? Certainly seems like it. Is he better off as president without the massive opposition of some of the people he managed to boot out of cabinet who are now out of parliament as well? Certainly Carol Payton believes that the die is sort of tilted in his favour. In a moment, Wayne McCurry, he is our market commentator on a day with the JSE added 0.5%, and we saw good gains across the resources sector, particularly in Kumba Iron Ore. Food manufacturers did well and banks bounced back too. That's coming up in a moment.
The Money Show. The Markets.
Wayne McCurry is with Wealth and Investments at FNB, and a positive day for the JSE. It's amazing what happens when you get politicians to stay off their Twitter accounts.
Yes.
Stop talking about recipes and to stop talking about the Reserve Bank, and then things tend to calm down.
Yeah. And in fact, when you look at the market, it's almost back as to... It's at the high that it was, 58, 59, 60,000 before all of the trade wars and Donald Trump's tweets and our politicians and the bad GDP number. And what saved it all is interest rate cuts are coming locally and overseas.
I don't want to upset the Reserve Bank governor because he's got enough on his plate. But I mean, I still think that they were wrong to raise rates last year. They raised by a quarter of a percentage point last year. And I know it was preemptive and it was cautious.
Yeah.
But
that was on the back of, you can make a very strong argument, of the Federal Reserve incorrectly raising rates last year. And we've got to attract capital. So we've got to keep the difference between our interest rates and global interest rates attractive for foreign investors. So maybe his hands were tied.
No, I have no doubt they were tied. The
Fed's going to cut rates imminently, and then we can afford to do it, especially given inflation's under control in South Africa because there's no demand, because there's no economy.
Yeah.
And as we said, the Federal Reserve's going to cut. So we're going to get the cut, and considering the first quarter GDP number, you need a cut.
Yes, we need a cut. It's quite interesting you say there's no demand in the economy, but then you look at results out of storage. Like, I think they're called
very different.
Are they called
storage?
Storage.
Yeah.
And they're these guys who do these self-storage units, the red ones with storage written on them.
Yeah, and it's franchise operation.
20 or so around the country. Mm. Those things seem pretty chock-a-block. People are utilizing them to hoard their stuff.
Yeah, they're getting 85% odd capacity utilization.
It's better than hotel rooms in South Africa.
I told you about 63.
Exactly.
Look, I think this is part of this whole scheme. You can't afford a big house and a big garden because rates and taxes and water and electricity and all of these things are horrendously expensive. So people are downscaling and they need space to store their junk that they'll never go visit. So I think it's a human thing. You like all your junk.
I wonder why we don't give it away.
No,
it's
good for storage because you go and store your junk. So I think it's got branches overseas because this has been a trend in the UK forever of going small, and you need a space to store all your stuff. And their earnings distribution was up 9%. They're still growing enormously. I think they added, about another 20% capacity or something, 100,000 square meters or something like that.
It's the sort of stuff that you were getting out of shopping centers and things like that at the peak of the returns you were getting out of the property sector. You're getting that out of a storage.
Yeah, and I mean, this was a massively fragmented industry. I mean, every single separate storage unit was a mom-and-pop type operation. Yeah. And they're coming in, buying a lot of these, giving them the systems, the methodology. A lot of it's franchise work. And I think it's working, and it's very similar to what's happening in Rosebank, and you can even say, yeah, in Sandton, these small residential units that are being built in the center of a town where you don't actually even have a car, maybe. You can use Uber and the Gautrain, and you can live without a garden, low rates and taxes, low water, low electricity. You sell your house, you move in there, you save thousands per month.
He's making a compelling argument.
And I think this is a continuing trend.
But you can't have a garage to weld in.
No, you can't. You've got to get a storage unit to go do your welding.
It's cheaper to do that still, yes, than have the massive property in order to do it. And the Tongaat debacle, please explain to me your... I mean, because yesterday we spent a lot of time discussing it and talking about the fact that this has been suspended at the request of the company. What's your reading of Tongaat? You've been looking at this company for years.
Well, it's been around for donkey's years. Okay. Yeah. From what we can make out, because we don't really know yet, they overvalued their land for resale and the cane fields.
Yeah.
Now, the cane fields, I can get that overvaluation because the price of sugar in rands has collapsed over the last while. So therefore, you thought it was worth, if you thought the output from that piece of cane land was worth X at a much higher price, it's now worth significantly less. So that write down's got to happen. And then land, there's no demand. They haven't sold any land, but yet they've developed a lot of land. And obviously the carrying value is much higher than the market, the current market value. And I guess what's happening there is they've sort of kept the values elevated on the hope that the economy will recover, therefore land prices will recover, therefore we'll sell more and we'll be able to justify the price. But it's got to a point now where they're just going to have to write it down. Whether the share should be suspended or not, I'm in two minds about that, because the market's the market.
I mean, the market, and we didn't
see... The market's the market.
People get very angry because they say, well, Steinhoff was a clear fraud and that share wasn't...
Was not suspended.
Was not suspended. Tongaat, there's no evidence necessarily of fraud.
Fraud per se, yes.
But they could have been accounting misstatements and that sort of stuff, which is a different thing.
The Steinhoff is different. Remember, that's a secondary listing, so they followed what the Frankfurt stock market did. Was it Frankfurt?
Yes.
Yeah, they followed what the Frankfurt stock, and they did not suspend it. But... A market's a market. When the truth eventually comes out, when you get the true situation of their financials, the market will adjust the price either up or down. But in the interim, you're dead. You're sitting with these shares that you cannot trade.
But is it? I mean, it's not really fair, is it? I mean, people take positions in markets all the time. You either go long, in other words, you buy a share and you hold on to it because you believe it'll go up, or you short it. You borrow some shares.
The guys who are on short, they can't cover their positions. They
can't. You can't sell your shares. You can't get out.
You can't get out. You're stuck. So I'm in two minds. Look, it's probably good for the company, certainly, to have the share suspended, because then they can just worry about carrying on with the business of the company.
The fix.
And fixing it up. Mm. They don't have to worry about bankers phoning them and collaterals and all of these things. But I'm not too sure whether it's good for the market, to be totally honest. But I'm in two minds. I'm not an expert in this thing. But I just think the market's the market.
And
if the short sellers are going to sell your share price down, then let them sell it down. And if they turn out to be wrong and the company's worth more than the last sell price, then they'll burn on the upside. So that's the way it is, I suppose. It's a market.
Wayne McCurry, thank you. He is with Wealth and Investments at FNB. Now, 2,000 Rand to give away this evening in our Fast Fact question on 31702 and 31567. Earlier, I asked you who uses the Taiwan-based Honhai Precision Industry to make its devices, Tabile, in the East Rand. What is the answer, please?
Hi, Bruce. The answer is Apple.
Well, Tabile, where now? Well done, Tabile. Congratulations. She's happy. And Tabile is 2,000 Rand better off as a result of that because, yes, Honhai, better known as Foxconn. You would have heard of Foxconn, but in Thailand, known as Honhai. Contract manufacturer, makes most of Apple phones on the Chinese mainland. But now it's having to have a plan B just in case the US-China trade talks get out of hand. And Apple, which is worried about tariffs being imposed in this tit-for-tat trade spat, has not yet given Honhai instructions to move production out of China, but Honhai is saying that it is capable of moving lines of production elsewhere. The last thing we need is for Apple cell phones to be even more expensive because of a trade war.
The Money Show is brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank.
We'll update you on the latest and the last in the current series of Solutionist Thinking in just a moment, just after Michael Pedro brings us the sport. But first, let me tell you that on the next Money Show, join me for shapeshifter Fred Root, the chief executive and founder of The Heavy Chef, to find out what the experiences they're creating for entrepreneurs. Also, Colin Cullis with Business Unusual. He'll be looking at arguments for changing the calendar and time zones. Going to get flack for that. Also, consumer journalist Wendy Nola with a cautionary tale if you're planning to rent out accommodation. Big lessons to be learned on the next Money Show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live. Online. Smartphones. DSTV. And 92.7. And 106 FM.
This is R&B Solutionist Thinking for the Creative Minds with a passion for possibility. And tonight we release the last episode in season two of R&B Solutionist Thinking. And what an incredible season it's been. It's been amazing. Trying to identify a single highlight has been like, ask who your favorite child is. And that's hard. But we've met some fascinating people. We've met some crazy people too. And they also can be fascinating. But that's the point of being a problem solver. Problems are not solved by people necessarily look at issues the same way as everyone else. It was a crazy idea that Aisha Pandor had, that she would address unemployment by providing an app which needs a smartphone to work. But today, more than 12,000 previously unemployed or underemployed women are registered with Sweep South. It was crazy to think that you could deliver ophthalmology, specialist eye care in rural areas without committing expensive medical specialists to a region. But Dr. William Mapham uses technology to do just that. And something like a Gary Kirsten, ex-Springbok cricketer, Proteas cricketer, an ambition to take cricket to township schools in a way that's not happened before. Arjuna Murray. I mean, talk about crazy. She remains committed to be one of the first humans to set foot on Mars. And possibly the most bonkers person of all, it's got to be Roger Barrow, who coaches the South African rowing team with a fraction of the resources that other global teams have. And he wants to go to the Olympics and bring back teams with big heaps of medals as well, with a fraction of those resources. And these are massively inspiring people, each and every single one of them. If you missed any of the episodes in season one and two, you can still download them on 702.co.za. You can get them at your favorite podcast app, but listen to them all. Listen to them again. They're a great resource. We've got a friend or a family member who's despondent about the state of the nation. Refer them, please, to Solutionist Thinking with RMB. If you're wondering whether it's a good idea to go into business with your best friends, listen to the Founders Podcast. That is Paul Harris, G.T. Ferreira, and Laurie Dippenaar. The three of them around a microphone for the first time, as far as we can tell, ever. And that was in season one. Well, tonight, let's go back to the final episode of season two of R&B Solutionist Thinking. Imagine finding out that you're going to become a parent, but your baby's got a birth defect. A birth defect that, with the appropriate skills and medical intervention, can be fixed in the womb with minimum risk to the mother and the child, and give that baby a better chance at a normal life when it's born. That's precisely what Professor Amos Nicolaou did, the academic head at the Wits Maternal and Fetal Medical Center. He recently managed to treat a baby in the womb suffering from spina bifida. Take a listen.
The feeling of enabling a child to actually have a reasonable life or almost normal life, that's, for me, is priceless. That's exactly what we have been doing all our lives, and that's exactly what the aim was of this surgery. But by creating this kind of excitement and these new techniques, obviously we establish more collaborations with the overseas centers. We want to work with the other centers overseas. We create awareness of people in South Africa. Colleagues of ours want to know what's going on, because that's, collaboration is very important. We need young doctors to say, hold on a second, I would like to do that, and come and sit with us and learn with us, because we need to leave a legacy behind us as well, that one day someone else will carry on doing this. And that's all of the above, actually.
So when we look at it and at the possible applications, this is to deal with spina bifida, but there are a plethora of things. Anybody who's ever been through a pregnancy understands just the stress and the excitement and all of these things, but you're always second guessing whether or not there's a problem. The opportunity to fix problems in the womb has got to be far bigger than just spina bifida. There are a multiplicity of applications, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. That was the beginning of, hopefully, of many more exciting things to come. We have been actually doing already procedures in utero. We have done many things from blood transfusions inside the womb, where babies, for example, get blood transfusions through the umbilical cord to save them from developing severe anemia. like in rhesus, for example, disease, to putting little catheters into their kidneys, their bladders, their chests, to allow their lungs, for example, to expand. So when the baby is born, he's able to breathe. So we have been doing these things for a number of years now with good success. But this is a level up. This is now proper surgery where you actually would operate on a baby like you would do when the baby is born. With the difference is that you do it much earlier and try and prevent irreversible damage.
And that was the final in our Solutionist Thinking episodes. And that, of course, is Professor Adamos Nicolaou, who's done amazing work in surgery in South Africa. Download that. All of the other podcasts, of course, via the 702.co.za website or via your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends. Make sure everybody gets to listen.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live. Online. Smartphones. DSTV. At 92.7. And 106 FM.
Would you ever stage a protest to get your boss back? Most people don't care enough about their bosses to even bother them to notice that they've gone. Never mind rock the boat once their immediate superiors left the building. And it's interesting to see, and I suspect the first time in almost a dozen CEOs over the past decade at SAA, that staff staged a protest to demand the reinstatement of the former SAA chief executive, Vuyani Jagane. He resigned about, 10 days ago now, fed up with the lack of support that he'd got from the shareholder, and you can read that as government, and his own board as well. And we had one of the directors on the board admit as much on Friday. Today, the South African Cabin Crew Association and the National Union of Metalworkers of South Africa embarked on a protest demanding his reinstatement, referring to him as our CEO. The president of the South African Cabin Crew Association is Zazi Nsibanyoni Mugambi. Zazi, what makes Vuyani Jagane such a special boss that you want him back so urgently?
Hi, thank you so much. Yes, we are obviously wanting our CEO back. And obviously it's because in a long time we haven't had a stable, permanent, efficient, hardworking CEO that is actually implementing the LTTS. So yes, we believe we bought into his strategy and we want to see it to fruition, which is 2021, and we want to see that happen. Yes, he wants our boss back, Bruce.
Did anybody ask him if he wants the job back? He seemed very keen not to have it at all.
Well, I think if you read his resignation letter, he says very clearly the reasons why he left. So I think we can't ignore that, Bruce. We need to look at the fact that he left because of the lack of support. He left because of the fact that the board and the shareholder was not supporting him. So I think if that was not the case, he still would have been here implementing the LTTS that we were backing.
And this is the first time, I think, in the history of the Cabin Crew Association and with NUMSA that you've ever stood up for a chief executive. I mean, the chief yeah. executives have come and gone in their droves at SAA. And I mean, not since Brian Molefe made that triumphant return to Eskom. And I'm not equating Jagane and Molefe for a second. But I mean, it's very seldom that you see a chief executive actually grasp the imagination of a workforce.
Yeah, I mean, Bruce, it's crunch time. I think... everyone is calling for the fact that SAA can no longer rely on the government to sustain itself. So we were behind that very same goal. So the reason why we are trying to push for Jagane particularly, which seems strange, is because it was actually happening. So we do not understand how he has been allowed to resign without anyone intervening, from the shareholder to the president himself. There is no other CEO, we believe, that it's going to change for. I mean, if they couldn't support him, who are they going to support, for crying out loud?
How scared are you guys about the future?
We're scared. I mean, look, SA has over 10,000 employees. This has a knock-on effect to the suppliers, everyone else. So we are extremely petrified. And the sad thing is, Bruce, we did not put ourselves in this position. We were put in this position, and we were finally given a CEO that is active, that understands where we need to go, who was actively implementing where we needed to go, and we are told he's gone and no one is doing anything to keep him. That's ludicrous.
And what about Zux Ramasia, the interim chief executive? She's been, I think she was head of operations, you'd know her well. Does she have your support in the interim?
Look, we understand that Zooks is an interim, so she's passing by, so to speak. Our worry is about the fact that we need someone permanent, and we know her. We've worked very well with Zooks Ramasia, so we don't have a particular problem with her. But we're not looking for an interim CEO. We're trying to get a CEO who has been working at SAA, who understands what he needs to do to turn it around so that taxpayers don't keep shouting at the fact that we keep having to bail SAA out. We need him to finish off what he started. So with Zooks, it's interim. We're talking about a permanent, competent CEO, Bruce.
Zazi, great pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much. Really insightful discussion that. Zazi Nsibayoni Mugambi, the president of the South African Cabin Crew Association, making this call to get the chief executive Vuyani Jagana back. It's unprecedented in the history of SAA to have this happen. They understand the issues very, very well. And it makes you wonder whether a government understands the issue. I mean, here you've got a workforce that is motivated by a chief executive who seems to have done a decent enough job at, you know, keeping the airline afloat. And if you are going to be serious about holding an airline within the state, as the government seems to be doing, then surely you've got to have somebody who has all everybody on side running the place. And if they, whatever the reasons were for his deep frustration, I'd love to talk to him about that, Vuyani Jagana, if you're listening. And you've got the support of the people within SAA. Do you want the job back? If you do, apply via the Money Show right now.
702. Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
So how big a deal is today's manufacturing number? Turns out any positive number in a sea of negativity is a big deal. We saw manufacturing in April increase by 4.6%, the biggest year-on-year percentage change in the volume of manufacturing production since June 2016, and much, much better than analysts had expected. I mean, am I gripping, Kevin Lings? Am I grasping at silver linings that may not be there? Chief Economist at StanLib, Kevin Lings tonight. Is there a silver lining, or am I like a drowning man grasping at a life vest?
Evening, Bruce. Now, I think that there is some positive in the number. Obviously, the number is a little bit flattered. The 4.6 is a year-on-year increase. And if you go back to April last year, it was a time when we had a lot of public holidays, and we also had some strike activity. And obviously, at that stage, activity or manufacturing was a little bit more subdued. We fast forward to this April, and less disruptions to that extent. And also, we were further away from the load shedding that we had early on in the year. So that, I think, helped a bit. So the year-on-year number off a low base, so maybe a little bit overstated in terms of the improvement. But month-on-month was up a decent amount, 2.8 in our terms. That's quite good. There were a number of sectors that showed a little bit more activity, and that may relate to more consistent electricity supply. I don't think it's indicative of the start of a solid pickup in manufacturing or a broad-based recovery, anything like that. But it certainly feels better. And I think the message to take away from this is that if we at least have consistent electricity supply, we're probably going to end up with a better manufacturing output for the second quarter. And what's important about this number is obviously we had that dreadful GDP number for the first quarter. What you don't want is another negative GDP in the second quarter, because then everybody refers to you as being in a technical recession. And obviously from a confidence point of view, that would hurt. So we need the second quarter to be positive. And this is a great start in getting there.
Yeah, okay. So we'll take this. We'll take the little silver lining that's been offered to us. It's amazing how quickly we forget about what happens in a week. I mean, we live in a very noisy society, in a very noisy country, where battles are fought out in the open, political battles, even if they have dire economic consequences. But with the political noise dying down, we seem to be heading back to a steady, I don't know, phony war perhaps, or maybe it's a steady state of denial about the real state of the economy, whatever it might be. But things do seem a bit calmer this week than when I saw you last.
Yeah, much calmer. The rand has strengthened a reasonable amount, obviously not back to where it was, but that anxiety seems to have calmed down, and certainly the outright anxiety about the Reserve Bank and the role of the Reserve Bank, et cetera, that seems to have eased off. And so I think that that's been a kind of a positive for how the mood has changed in this country. Also, the other thing is that the oil price has come off quite sharply. So even though the currency net-net is a little bit weaker, we're actually looking at a very substantial petrol price reduction next month. And clearly that would start to help us as well. So it has got a slightly better feel. It doesn't mean that we are getting a hell of a lot more optimistic, but perhaps as the data comes through now, if we can keep the lights on, so to speak, we probably end up with a small positive for the second quarter, and that could start to signal a better economic environment overall.
From your lips, Kevin Lings, thank you, the Chief Economist at Stanlib.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702. For the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Good evening. Welcome to The Money Show, brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank. We'll talk to Andy Rice in just a moment, the branding and advertising expert. He's on the line to us in Johannesburg this evening with these heroes and zeros. And then Rona Kapoldis, Director and Africa Analyst at Signal Risk, in studio with us this evening. He wants to talk to Sudan, Botswana, Zambia and Malawi, reflections on the recent election there. And then at 7:30, we're going to be looking at a publishing phenomenon. That publishing phenomenon being not Freyvjeplat, Landbouwvjeplat. Freyvjeplat is a publishing phenomenon. It's made a comeback. It's online. But Landbouwvjeplat still in print and still being delivered old school. Who's its market nowadays? Do you read Landbouwvjeplat? Is agriculture interest you? Do you like the stories of campaigning against the odds, against the weather? And we'll talk about land, of course. Maybe it's concerns around land restitution. There's got the volumes of sales of Landbouwvjeplat rising in a market where otherwise magazine sales are not spectacular. So that conversation happening at 7:30. And our How It Works feature, that's all coming up on The Money Show tonight.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live, online, smartphones, DSTV, and 92.7 and 106 FM.
Andy Rice with Heroes and Zeros this evening on the line to us from Johannesburg. Andy Rice, how is the world of advertising this Tuesday night? No big criminals, no big sinners, no big wastrels of the advertising dollar this week?
No, I think the scoundrels have left advertising and gone into mainstream finance.
Oh, Andy, ow, that would hurt, I think. But there are people who've done that have no feelings at all. Andy, tell me about your hero.
Okay, well, there's a really quite exceptional thing on television at the moment, and that is an advertising campaign for an insurance company that contains no shouting out to the rates, no claims of huge savings, no bonuses, no cashback, nothing about the nuts and bolts and the numbers. Just an unspoken message that says, we get you. We understand you. We know about your lives. And if you then go on further and commit yourself to a particular demographic or audience, in your brand name even, then you better make sure you do understand these people and their lifestyles. And, of course, that brand name and that demographic is women and first for women. And they have a campaign running on television at the moment. If you like a corporate campaign, I'm quite sure they do all the rates advertising somewhere else in different media. But on television, here's a lovely montage of authentic South African women. They're not models. They're not chosen for their looks or anything. They're chosen because they represent, if you like, middle South Africa, the aspirational woman fighting in a times unfair world. And it shows them battling at times with the smaller things in life, perhaps. You know, getting to the gym, seeing if you can afford a new dress, the challenge of shopping, the temptations of shopping, the work challenge of making presentations to big audiences. All these things are shown and edited together to a soundtrack that's quite familiar to most of us, which is the old Push It song, which in my era was made a big hit by Salt and Pepper, but I'm quite sure there have been more recent coverings. Bruce, you would know about that.
I wouldn't. I listened to it earlier, and I had absolutely zero recall. Let's have a quick listen, because I don't remember this one bit. Somewhere deep in the recesses of my mind, it is buried. But I think it's good that it stays buried. But you like it, Andy?
I do, yes. And you know, I think that when a brand gets the music soundtrack right and fits in with the mood of the visuals, I think it more than doubles the impact of a commercial. So it's Hero this week. It's a first for women. They're getting their prospective customers to, I think, nod along in agreement and to say to themselves, I can see me up there on that screen.
I don't know if it was first for women or an advertiser similar marketing to women, which showed men doing stupid things and then saying, this is why we don't insure men.
That was first for women.
It
yes,
was first for women. So they've gone from the cheek to the aspirational.
Well, they've gone the other way around. Rather than saying, this is why we don't offer insurance to men, they've now gone, this is why we do offer insurance to women. I think the one that stood out for me in that old campaign was when the sort of four likely lads drove their car backwards to Cape Town from Johannesburg.
That was the one.
Yes,
I wouldn't insure them either. First for Women gets a Hero this evening, Andy. Thank you for that. And your Zero, we always have to have a Zero.
We do indeed. And this one is about the impact of the location or environment in which advertising sits and how that can multiply the impact or reduce the impact if you put it in the wrong environment. So a good example of that would be the Haltrain, where if you drive up and down the M1, particularly in rush hour, you'll find those billboards on the overhead bridges reminding you that you could have been there an hour ago if you'd taken the Haltrain. So very clever location of the message to the point of pain, if you like. A bad example would be this obsession with getting computers and bots to do the programmatic buying of advertising space online, which all too often ends up with perfectly respectable brands running banner ads unintentionally on rather less respectable websites. So there's a good example and a bad example of how you can multiply the efficiency of an ad depending on where it sits. Now, some weeks ago, and I'm not sure if the ad is still up, but if you take the airport approach road from the M2 in Cape Town, and you're heading towards the airport, there are a number of warehouses and office blocks and things on the right-hand side you drive there. And on one of them is a very substantial and no doubt very expensive billboard for a particular airline. And that's great. It's obviously, again, in the right place at the right time, except for the fact that the billboard is almost completely obscured by an adjacent building if you're driving on the left-hand side of the road heading up that way. And only as you just about draw alongside, if you're prepared to risk taking your eyes off the road for quite some time, you'll see that it's actually an Emirates billboard because the logo of Emirates is in the far right-hand bottom corner, which is the most obscured by the building. So it just strikes me that either the media owners weren't entirely frank with their client about the visibility of this billboard, and perhaps also, I think Emirates should have perhaps done a bit of site checking, just get out there and make sure that all their billboards that they're paying for are delivering the message that they could. So it's a kind of half hero each for the media owner and for Emirates for this one.
I wonder, Andy, I mean, should you be advertising your airline brand en route to the airport? Because I've already made my purchase decision when I'm on my way to the airport. All I'm going to do is go, oh, FOMO, I've missed out on an opportunity to go on a much sexier looking airline than the one I've chosen. Surely a more effective advertising strategy, and you've done this for a while now, would be to say, did you like your flight? Try us next time if you didn't already, and have that on the way out of the airport, because most of us, by the time we get off a flight, no matter how good it was, feel grumpy about something and may be more inclined to try the competition if we didn't do them already.
Well, that's a valid argument. I think that the more frequent the flyer, and someone like you who is constantly jetting around the world,
such a jet setter,
billboards here, there, and everywhere. And I think there is an opportunity because one of the other things about the environment is not to be cluttered. So if your argument holds water, then there would be, and there probably are, lots more ads to compete with on the way out of the airport than on the way in.
Good point, Andy. Good point. Always good points. Andy Rice, thank you. With the branding and advertising feature on a Tuesday night, our Heroes and Zeros. First for Women gets a hero for their catchy advertising on why they ensure women and women only. And then the Zero on the way to the airport, Cape Town's N2. There's a big Emirates billboard, which you wouldn't know was an Emirates billboard because the airport, the billboard is obscured by a great big fat building. If you are going to stick your logo on an obscured billboard, ensure that the logo is standing out. I know your aeroplanes are pretty and big and shiny. That's nice. But so are everyone else's. We need to see your logo.
The Africa Business Report.
Africa Business Report brought to you by SNG Grant Thornton, an integration of local audit and advisory pioneer SNG and global frontrunner Grant Thornton. In studio with us tonight, he's often on the line to us from London, but Rona Kapoldis, the director and Africa analyst at Signal Risk. Sudan, explain. Please, it's a disaster.
Yeah, a really tragic week last week. Over 100 people died. They got suspended from the African Union. Internet was shut down. And these developments really come weeks after the removal of Omar al-Bashir, who was the president since 1989. You know, after he was displaced, the military and the generals took power and they formed the Transitional Military Council. And they were locked in negotiations with the civilians. And those talks collapsed. And then they opened fire against protesters in Khartoum. And that's kind of precipitated the current crisis, this crisis of legitimacy. So we always knew the road to civilian government was going to be a messy one. You know, we've got recent examples, Egypt, Zimbabwe, Algeria, where after the euphoria dies down, things don't really go according to plan. But this situation has really exposed the fractures within the military, the civilians, the paramilitary groups and the militia groups. And it's further complicated by the geopolitical dynamics because the Transitional Military Council is getting funding from some key Gulf allies like Saudi Arabia and the UAE, which is really complicating the situation.
But you look at the potential powder keg scenarios that could play out here. If you just look at what happened, I mean, whether you liked Saddam Hussein or tolerated Saddam Hussein simply because he was a stabilizing force in the Middle East, you remove him. And ISIS happened. You know, you have a civil war situation brewing in Sudan, you know, really threatening to scale up.
Yeah, and it's a key region in general. So, you know, in this context of a kind of Cold War 2.0 scenario, a game of geopolitical chess where global powers are again trying to be relevant on the African continent. I think, you know, the situation in Sudan is really important in terms of what it means as a kind of bellwether for the engagement of these powers on the rest of the continent.
And tell me about Botswana. I mean, we've got this political fallout between Khama and Masisi, and it's unbecoming. And I mean, in a place where you've had stability for a long time, and Botswana's got a great global image, and they're doing amazing things, but political leaders shouldn't be shouting at each other.
Yeah, I mean, we used to call it boring Botswana, not so much anymore. So basically, Ian Khama, his term was up. He handpicked a successor, President Masisi, and things haven't really gone according to plan. Huge changes in personnel and policy, and we've seen major factionalism within the BDP to such an extent that Ian Khama actually resigned from the party, which his family name is synonymous with. So that's kind of set the cat amongst the pigeons. They've got elections coming up, and there's a very real threat now that this factionalism results in the BDP getting under 50% of the vote share, which will introduce some more uncertainty into the economic landscape. And of course, there are big question marks around whether the economy is also going to be used as political football as these dynamics play out.
I mean, I was just chatting to somebody over the weekend in the tourism trade in Botswana. They're getting quite edgy. They're getting a little bit nervous about the politics of Botswana. Not something they've ever had to worry about before. Nothing that De Beers has had to worry about before. They've had a really good working relationship, a mutually beneficial relationship with Debswana, which is the state-owned diamond company. And De Beers, I mean, are businesses at risk in Botswana, do you think?
I mean, you know, in election years, there's always uncertainty. In terms of engagement with De Beers are currently being renegotiated. There's the issue with the elephant hunting that's currently been reversed, which marks a very major shift from the Ian Khama era of conservation policy. So, you know, there are kind of various dynamics that are changing, and I think that's to be expected in an election year. That said, Botswana is still an A-rated country, and you know, I think while investors need to be jittery up until the election, things should stabilize after that.
Well, I hope so. Zambia, in mining sector, the mining sector is what's keeping Zambia going. Copper has been the lifeblood of the Zambian economy for decades. And now government's going, I know what we should do. Let's interfere.
Yeah, so resource nationalism, not really a new theme in Zambia. And I think, you know, the current developments where they're effectively getting divorced from Vedanta, the Indian commodity company, is creating a lot more questions than answers. And I think we need to really separate two issues over here. One is the merits of the case. And, you know, speaking to people on the ground, I was there last week, you know, the sentiment coming out is that Vedanta haven't been the best corporate citizens and that there is potentially a case there. However, the manner in which the situation is being handled, which seems to be quite arbitrary, quite draconian, and really is souring investor sentiment in a context where it seems like there's a political agenda, one, to curry favor ahead of the 2021 elections, and two, to kind of use the private sector to plug fiscal holes, is what's creating a lot of anxiety. And this comes in a context where the yields on Zambia's Eurobonds are 22% last week. There's still uncertainty around its engagement with the IMF and how it's going to tackle its fiscal situation. So I think the situation in Zambia is definitely cause for concern. And again, you know, separating the merits of the particular issue, which might be legitimate, versus the manner in which it's being executed is important.
And it's interesting because, I mean, Venkat has gone to be CEO of Vedanta, Srinivasan Venkatakrishnan, the former chief executive of AngloGold Ashanti. And he's fairly new in the job, and he's an amiable kind of guy. One wonders whether or not he can make Bill Bridges in Zambia. Tell me about Malawi's election. Malawi is not exactly a powerhouse, an economic powerhouse. It has big issues, and they've got nailed in the cyclones over this last summer season. It's had a tough time. The elections, any hope there?
Yeah, they haven't gone very well. I mean, they had their elections on the 21st of May, and then we saw all the usual stuff that we've come to associate with elections across the continent. Allegations of impartiality from the Electoral Commission, allegations of fraud, vote rigging, conspiracies, violence, media crackdowns. And, you know, what was interesting is that the opposition claimed that the ballots were doctored with Tippex. I was quite surprised that anyone still uses Tippex.
I used some the other day. The kids were like, why are you painting a piece of paper? But shush, you don't understand what you're dealing with, children.
It hasn't really kind of been smooth sailing, question marks around the legitimacy. And now they protest both through the courts and the streets. Unlikely that the court protests will succeed. So the opposition have taken their protests to the streets. And last week, the police used tear gas. And that's, you know, indicated that the government is not afraid to use hardline tactics. The rhetoric coming out of President Peter Mutharika's mouth on the 6th of June was around the opposition wanting to overthrow the government by force. So, again, very messy situation. We haven't really heard anything from regional bodies like the African Union. But like you said, you know, this is a country that needs a smooth political environment because it's been hard hit by the cyclone, they've had drought, and it's not exactly an economic powerhouse. So, yeah, the sooner Malawi can restore political stability, the better.
Absolutely essential. Are you going to be paying particular attention out of London next week when Cyril Ramaphosa delivers his State of the Nation address? South Africa and African economy, of course, a critical African economy, and an African economy that is vulnerable, I'm going to use that word.
Of course. I mean, you know, new administration, new dawn, lots of factionalism in the ruling party, lots of mixed messaging. So what we want to see is kind of firm, clear, decisive and coherent policy. We're not getting that at the moment. So definitely we'll be watching that with bated breath.
My thanks to Ronak Kapoldis, who is Director and Africa Analyst at Signal Risk, with our Africa Business Report this evening. The stories out of Sudan and a real risk of civil war there. The massacre in Khartoum last week not helping anybody. Botswana, political fallout there. And just talking to people who do business in Botswana, you get a sense of edginess. People are concerned that after years of stability and growth and a solid performance in Botswana, things are changing there. Zambia, again, one of the great tragedies of a country that could be doing so much better. Strong commodity presence, strong copper production, great tourism opportunities, way beyond Livingstone and Vic Falls. I mean, it's a beautiful place and lots of opportunities there. And Malawi too. I mean, lots of people love to visit Malawi. And Malawi gin. I don't know if you've never had Malawi gin. Have you had Malawi gin? No, you haven't had Malawi gin. We should get Malawi gin. It should be the export. It should be the export product of epic proportions. It beats. Sorry to everybody who does these luxury gins in South Africa that charge $500 a bottle. Malawi gin. I'm sure we can get it cheaper, and it's. Oh, I shouldn't be expressing my proclivities so clearly on the radio. But Malawi gin, boring bottle, boring label, nice contents.
702, Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
Welcome to the editor of Landbouw. We keep on saying Vrye Weekblad. It's not free. You have to pay money for it. It's Landbouw Weekblad. It's 100 years old this year. And I went into the Naspers headquarters the other day in Cape Town, and I saw this magnificent display of old covers going back decades. And it's inspired me to get hold of Chris Burgess and say, please, come and talk to me about this phenomenon in publishing. Because, Chris, you edit this niche magazine in what's broadly a dying industry. How is Landbouw Weekblad holding up?
Good evening, Bruce. I'm a big fan of yours. Remarkably well, turns out.
Oh, that's good.
So the dying industry, I hope you're not referring to agriculture.
No. Agriculture is holding on by the skin of its teeth, but print media is tragically dying. I like a good magazine.
Just like any other print product, we have our problems. Circulation has been declining over the past few years. Farmers have also been getting fewer. I mean, we're losing about 1,500 farmers a year. On the print product, we've been losing advertising revenue, but we've had quite an aggressive diversification strategy on the brand. So we've we don't just do print anymore. The print product is, that's still the flagship product, and that's the sort of editorial funnel where everything comes in. But we're doing a TV program, which is doing phenomenally well, Landbouw Weekliks, which is a weekly a farming program. We do conferences, do a lot on regenerative agriculture, two big conferences in Reitz and Otters Dahl. We do standalone magazines, Landbouw Weekblad. We have the biggest food magazine, freestanding food magazine, sold food magazine in the country. Belongs to us, which we're very proud of.
What's the title?
Boerekos.
Boerekos. Well, there's a title for a magazine.
You
yeah?
can't miss that. Yeah.
So what does it feature? I'm joking. you're underselling, I think, quite a landmark conference which you held. I mean, you talk about conferences, but you did have a big conference on land, and you'd got quite a lot of praise, I think, for getting very key role players around the table at a time of a real tension within the land debate and the land space. And I mean, there's always going to be tension about land in South Africa. It's with good reason. But I mean, you took quite a big risk, I think, in facilitating at a fractious time a discussion on land, especially with a magazine, a business with a heritage of 100 years in backing farmers.
Well, there should be a lot less tension around land because, we've got... have got some of the most flexible and innovative land reform models that you'll find anywhere in the world. And what really happened was it was sort of born out of frustration because, we're sort of stuck in this debate around expropriation without compensation. And it sort of became, we all know it sort of became a political football, and we were all aware of the fact that the Constitution actually already allowed it. And we had the report by former President Galema Motlanthe where he quite pertinently said that the problem with land reform wasn't land reform, it was the state. And he said that in no uncertain terms. And that sort of seemed to get lost in all the noise. So... You know, we having worked in agriculture, and it's often quite difficult to get these stories out into the mainstream media. You know, we've had to do with some phenomenal people in the past, you know, 20 odd years that I've been working in agriculture. And we decided, you know, everyone's speaking for the farmers. The academics have something to say, and the politicians have something to say, and the suburbanites have something to say about land reform. Maybe it should be time to get the farmers to say something about land reform. So we got 65 case studies together that we knew about, the best that we had, that we could find, and we got them all together in Bella Bella, basically because Louis van der Watt gave us the auction facilities basically for free. So that was the reason why we had it in Bella Bella. And we got 65 speakers, 2 days, everyone had 10 minutes to come and state their case. We were quite insistent that it should be farmers, that it should be primary agriculture, or rather should come from the agricultural sector, because we felt quite strongly that agriculture's voice should be heard. And the day before the AgriSA were our partners in this venture, and the day before the conference, we got the info. We were told that the deputy president wanted to open the conference, and we were vehemently opposed to it, until somebody sort of delicately pointed out that he was, after all, the deputy president. So we relented, and he opened. He did come and open the conference, and it was quite extraordinary. I mean, he delivered
I'm lost on the timeline here a little bit. Was this Cyril Ramaphosa,
no,
Deputy President, Didi Mabuza?
Okay. Didi Mabuza, yeah. Now, he came and he gave a very conciliatory speech, and the RAND actually picked up a little after that speech, we were told. We had the DG of Agriculture there for the entire conference. We had the Minister of Land Reform there at the time, who was the Minister of Land Reform at the time. And it was just an extraordinary, we basically battered people with positivity for 2 days. And the result was quite extraordinary. People hadn't heard these stories. People weren't aware of the absolute phenomenal work that is already being done in land reform. Across all sectors of agriculture, from restitution farms that have fallen into disrepair, that have been gone into co-ventures with the biggest private citrus exporters in South Africa, to family farms that have been reconfigured and 10% have been given to workers, to communal farmers from Mrs. Gloria Sorobe's fantastic projects in Clintani in the Transkei to the communal wool farmers who've been sort of like being plugged into international export value chain, to the Bonnievale School, Philip Jonker and his three mates, it's 120 million rand technical school that they erected out of nothing, or Kusi van Sail, a grain farmer out in Bredasdorp that has been mentoring brown farmers who have now taken over the mentoring role themselves. He's got a children's home on his farm. I mean, just a really extraordinary stories about South Africa. And the amazing thing about most of these is that they actually all make business sense. So it's a complete win-win situation. You know, if you look at somebody like Jeff Every, who's a true great South African, Amadlelo Agri is a consortium of, I think it was 70 of our biggest dairy farmers. And Jeff had been consulting to them for many years. And at some point he said, you know, chaps, it's time to start plowing something back. And they went into the former homelands of the Siskai and they identified ground, which they then rented from the communities. And then they brought the infrastructure and the animals. And ironically enough, put up these world-class dairies in the former homelands where the nationalist government had put in infrastructure that had just fallen into complete disrepair. And I mean, you've got these world-class dairies in communal areas where this should not be happening. So, you know, and I think the big impact that that the conference did have, it sort of gave people hope that things aren't lost, you know, that we can come up with solutions.
If you pay attention to the politics of land, you're not ever going to be able to see the work of land and the work that has been done in land. And many people have tried and some have failed and many more will try and fail. But there is an extraordinary amount of goodwill in agriculture, because I think agriculture knows that unless it does transform itself, it is going to have the transformation imposed upon it, and it's not necessarily going to like that particular, you know, the outcome that is imposed upon it.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think that agriculture is far more transformed than people know, and that, you know, people appreciate. You know, I'm just thinking of one example. For instance, Anthony Evans, there out of your world, from Viljoenskroon.
Yeah, the late Anthony Evans was a remarkable individual. But yeah, please tell me the story that you've got.
Yeah, and he was a finalist in the commercial beef farmer of the year competition with the Sussex Stud out there at Hunter's Fly, and he didn't
That's because he used to buy bulls from my dad, and those genes that made his herd. You see, that's my argument anyway.
Well, it's a very compelling argument. at the award ceremony, he came to us and said, you know, we need to get black farmers in here as finalists. You know, so we've got a very good friend, Soy Harman, who's also an extraordinary guy, also spoke at Bella Bella. He does mentoring work up in the Northwest. I think he's got something like 200 Tswana cattle farmers that he mentors. We went to him and said, listen, we need some finalists here. And he suggested this phenomenal farmer, Klanyan Khaskoma, and we wrote him in and we nominated him, and he ended up winning the commercial cattle farmer of the year. And I mean, that was real true South African history. That had never happened before, that a black farmer had won a commercial cattle farmer award. And that sort of went by unnoticed by the mainstream media, and which was pity, because, you know, it was a real milestone, you know. And these are the stories that are happening all the time, and no one sees it and no one picks it up, because we are focusing on the politicians who aren't taking us any further.
I'm talking to Chris Burgess this evening, who is enlightening us all about the world of agriculture, South African agriculture. It is a discussion about Lumpo Vierkblad, but it's gone so much broader than that, because in order to be sustainable, publications like Lumpo Vierkblad have got to diversify their interests, and in doing so, are able to facilitate conversations that are not happening in the mainstream, as Chris points out. More with him in a moment.
The Money Show is brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank.
So for 100 years, Lumpo Vierkblad has been featuring a particular demographic of South Africa's agricultural sector. Started in 1919, the magazine has always been owned by Naspers. I mean, Naspers goes back to those days. Was Lumpo Vierkblad always a Naspers publication? Chris Burgess, editor of Lumpo Vierkblad.
Yeah, it has. I mean, from the beginning, it was one of the first titles, and one of, I think, three or four titles that are still standing after 100 years. Yeah, the initial idea, of course, behind Lumpo Vierkblad was to try and commercialize the Afrikaner subsistence farmers that had been impoverished by the Boer War, and you know, that was sort of part of the greater opheffings effort by the nationalists, by the Afrikaner community.
This was the so-called poor white problem. This was an attempt to try and get these subsistence farmers, the Baivo and those people, to sort of an early empowerment project, if you like.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think people really appreciate the devastation that was wreaked on the farming communities in the Free State and the then Transvaal. And I mean, it wasn't just the Baivoeners; it was also commercial guys. You know, commercial, you know, people that had been farmers that had substantial land holdings and substantial stock before the war had nothing when they got back. Yeah. And this was a real problem. And they also realized that the economy was being formalized, and you know, they were going to have to go a little bit more scientifically about it. You know, you didn't have limitless land on which you could farm.
I mean, but my impression of Lumpo Vierkblad is it used to be a very ernstige publication. It was very, you know, very serious about farming, and I'm sure you still are very serious about agriculture, but you've got a softer touch about it now. I mean, the covers are a little bit more appealing and perhaps a little bit more frivolous. There was a wonderful one that I saw in the display that you had up at Naspers, of a father and son jumping in rain puddles, for example, and celebrating the arrival of the rain, because anybody who's ever lived on a farm knows there's nothing more important than the arrival of the rain. But you can actually celebrate the joys of agriculture. It doesn't have to be deadly serious all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I think agriculture is serious enough as it is. Exactly. So, I mean, when we do get the opportunity to feature a cover like that, I mean, what a joy! And it was such a, I mean, it was such a popular cover that because it had come after the big rains, and you know, every farmer, you know, that saw a cover like that could so identify with that sort of moment of spontaneity. So it was it was absolutely lovely. Lovely cover. So when we ever, and it was actually sent in by a farmer. So those are actually the best covers that we get, are those that we receive from readers.
What's your mission? What do you see as the editor of L'Ambuurwerkblad? What do you see as the role of a publication like L'Ambuurwerkblad in its pages? And then obviously, I mean, you've described to us the conferences and the impact that you've had and how you've managed to get people talking. I mean, is that the role? Is it the sort of facilitation role that to try and get a transformation of South Africa's land in a peaceful way?
Yeah, I think our mission is very much what that first editor, Dr. Frans Gelden, has had 100 years ago. You know, it's to basically make sure that agriculture is still around after 100 years. And I mean, that means that, you know, that it's not good enough to just dispense information. You know, we need to do that too, of course, but. You know, I think, as you say, I think a facilitatory role is specifically at this juncture in South Africa. I mean, you know, there's not much we can tell a sort of export citrus farmer. I mean, they, you know, technically they're some of the best farmers in the world. So, I mean, what do you tell a guy like that, you know? So you have to give him context and you have to provide him some other service. And a facilitatory role is maybe, you know, there's a big need for that. I mean, as we saw with Bella Bella, but it's also, you know, to sort of provide the context to farmers that are stuck on farms. You know, so you know our other big drive is regenerative agriculture, which is looking at how farmers can get by with fewer inputs. You know, because these are all imported, and we know what the rand does. So, you know, to try and look how does one farm more in tune with nature, and how does one get the natural services that Mother Nature wants to provide for us for free? How do we get her to provide those for free? And then of course to illustrate best practice. You know, I mean, if you're farming, it's quite amazing. You know, often you've got a farmer in one district and they don't know what's happening in 100 kilometers down the road. So I think, I mean, in a nutshell, I think our mission will be to have agriculture around in South Africa in 100 years' time, and to build an inclusive and productive and profitable agricultural sector. And the frustration is at the moment is that it is so possible. I mean, it is within our grasp. Our farmers are of the best in the world, and I mean, I don't say that flippantly. They really are of the best. We have all the models for land reform. It's all there, you know. I mean, so agriculture could play such a pivotal role on so many levels in South Africa, you know, not only in terms of earning foreign exchange, employment, rejuvenating the platteland, you know, it could also, it could give us a new sense of purpose, you know.
When you go through these small towns, and I mean, you mentioned Viljoenskroon earlier, from whence I emanate, and I wrote a column once about, you know, I went back to go and visit the town, and it was, you know, Viljoenskroon was the original one-horse town. It was named after a guy called Viljoen, who had a horse called Kroon. So it was a proper one-horse town. But somebody had shot the horse and stolen the saddle. I mean, so many of these towns are dead. They are desperate and sad and tragic places, and agriculture does need to play a bigger role in the restoration of these places.
Well, they do. I mean, agriculture really does try and play a role. I mean, you've had Chris Skutter from Astral on your show. I mean, you know, you speak to the guys from NVCAR up in Lichtenberg. You know, they tear their hair out in frustration because, I mean, all the expertise is there. You know, and this is the tragedy about agriculture is that you most likely, agriculture is one of the economic sectors in South Africa that is still truly world class and that has some of the most extraordinary managers in the entire economy because they have to juggle so many variables. And you have these people in the platteland, the most extraordinary managerial talent right there. But the local government, local municipalities refuse to speak to these people. I mean, you speak to Chris Skutter, they try for months and months to get a interview with the mayor. And when they do get an interview with the mayor, nothing happens.
Yeah.
Until in complete frustration, they do it themselves. So it can be turned around, and this is the frustration of agriculture. It's right there. But there's a political block that we can't get past.
Chris Burgess, I wish you luck with the mission to broaden agriculture, to get more people understanding agriculture, understanding the real issues in agriculture beyond the politics and the politicking, and getting a sustainable agriculture sector that allows for jobs to be created, allows for land to be made available to those people who want to seriously farm the land and grow the products and empower themselves and benefit the country. I think it's a great mission. Chris Burgess, the editor of 100 Years of Landbou Weekblad. I wonder what Dr. Frans Geldenhuys would think of today's Landbou Weekblad. It seems like far too much fun nowadays compared to what it was 100 years ago. But the issues are alarmingly similar 100 years on.